Hi, this is Kevin Barrett of Truth Jihad Radio, looking for truth even if it doesn't fit anybody's party line. I'm free to do that thanks to the generosity of my sponsors and subscribers. To sponsor or subscribe, please go to truthjihad.com. Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the Truth Jihad, riding on the white horse, looking for the way things really are, and bringing on people who can help me figure it out. Every now and then, somebody who can help me figure it out by being a complete idiot I can fight with, but that's not the case today. As in most shows, I'm bringing on somebody I greatly respect, and that is Ian Greenhall, my friend and colleague from Veterans Today. Ian is one of the more knowledgeable people that I've met in terms of actually having read quite a bit and seeing through the surface lies to the ugly beating heart of truth. It's often ugly anyway, especially the kind of truths we're dealing with here in politics and so on. And Ian has a couple of interesting pieces recently cutting against the grain of the misguided Trump worship that pervades certain segments of the so-called alternative media. He's got a piece defending George Soros, oh my God, and a piece about Trump appealing to his ignorant racist base. And as much as I hate to admit it, given that some of my truther friends and colleagues have fallen for Donald Trump, I think Ian's absolutely right. So, hey, what do you think, Ian? Are you right?
I mean, I'm one of those people that I'm not conceited enough to ever think that I'm always right. And I can be an idiot sometimes, you know. But the key thing to making mistakes is learning from them and not repeating them. And that gives me an interesting little segue into answering the Soros question.
Yeah. I mean, wait a minute. You say Soros is the good guy, Trump's the bad guy? I mean, half my audience is going to come lynch us.
Yeah, well, I can't give you a quick answer. So I'll give you the full fat, full-bodied one. That I'm one of those people that when I hear something that sounds interesting, I don't immediately say, oh, that must be right or that must be wrong. I look into it for myself. And during the time of the run-up to the election, I was writing a series of articles that attacked Donald Trump. And I attacked him. I really went for him. And I would stand by everything I wrote, though. And at the same time as I was really, really going after Trump, large numbers of commenters were going after me for not saying equally bad things about the Clintons and George Soros. So I decided that it was only right for me to spend an equal amount of time looking into stories that about the Clintons and Soros as I was about Donald Trump and Sheldon Adelson, who is one of the leading financiers of the neocon Zionist cabal, which is my insistent point that that's who installed Donald Trump into office. But whenever I looked into things about Trump and Adelson, you know, they always led me to proper dirt. You know, things that were true, things that I could verify. When I went the other way, you always look at the source first. Who wrote the article and who that person works for? And I found I was going back over well-trodden ground, that somebody else had done it all before me. And his name was Steve Kangas. And he was I think he was a former policeman, but he became an investigative journalist. And he was hired to look in the 1980s, to look into who was behind the very, very well-financed, very well resourced and very widespread anti-Clinton propaganda that was coming out. and Kangas ended up being shot, I think, in the men's room of a office building that he had gone to confront one of the people who he had uncovered was, you know, behind the anti-Clinton work that was going on.
Yes, I remember this. That's an interesting case, and it's funny that it's been largely forgotten.
Well, that's because the people who run the media are the self-same people who were responsible for the demise of Steve Kangas. He was dangerous. You know, that he was somebody who was doing something that has become a lost art, and that's proper investigative journalism. And I, in my own, stuck in England way, I was doing a similar thing. I was trying to do investigative journalism using, what was available online. And I, in every instance where I looked into a anti-Clinton or anti-Soros story, that usually because a commenter would say, oh, but what about X? And I looked in,
I'm going to give you a couple of those, so just give me some time.
Sure.
Yeah, but go ahead.
But every single time, didn't get very far, because it turns out that either the person that wrote it and the people that they work for were on the list of those who have no credibility because they have been exposed as working for the Zionist neocon cabal. And I am awful with names, and I can't remember specific examples of names of people, but the long and the short of it is...
The vast right-wing conspiracy that Hillary talked about actually is real.
Correct. And it's people like Sheldon Adelson and Ronald Lauder and the... Is it the Bronfmans, the people that own the Seagram's whiskey?
Yes. The Bronfmans not only own Seagram's whiskey, they pretty much own Canada.
Well, yeah, and they're also deeply involved in the creation of the Mossad and the killing of JFK, but that's a digression.
Yes, yeah. They're top-level kosher nostra.
Well, basically, the top-level kosher nostra, and I've just named three tentacles of that in Adelson, Lauder, and the Bronfmans, that's who's financing the anti-Clinton campaign. It's also the people who are behind the anti-Soros campaign. I mean, I'll give you one example of how they twist things with Soros. That Soros said, I put $5 billion into regime change in Ukraine. I think they missed out a word. Preventing regime change in Ukraine. He was trying to stop what has happened in Ukraine. What has happened in Ukraine is that you had a repeat of the Bolshevik takeover of Russia in 1917, where a group of ostensibly Ukrainian, but not really, people have seized power through the hiring of street thugs. Because that's all it was. Maidan, they got everybody gathered there, like sitting ducks, brought in half a dozen snipers, stuck them in the Europa Hotel and said, there you go, kill a few people from either side and that'll really kick things off. Which is what they did. Within a day or two, we had the fall of the government and the imposition of a klepto oligarchic dictatorship.
But wait a minute. What was Soros' role here? Because most people would agree that Soros has worked generally cooperatively with USAID and other CIA-linked organizations, which kind of have a two-pronged agenda. One is to so-called promote democracy, and there is a certain amount of legitimate sort of supporting of the rights of dissidents not to be tortured and civil society and all this sort of thing. And at the same time, though, it's obviously being leveraged for imperial interests and, mm-hmm. Against anti-U.S. empire interests, or in some cases, Zionist interests. So in Ukraine, I mean, wouldn't you agree that most of the Soros money, like the USAID money, was in fact probably promoting folks who would tend to be more on the Ukrainian nationalist side and against the Russians?
Well, it's complex with Ukraine because Soros hates the Russians.
Exactly, like Brzezinski.
Yes. He hates them because of what happened in 1956. And actually, I'll tell that story because it's vital background in the bigger picture. Everybody knows that in 1956 there was the Hungarian uprising, where the Hungarian people rose up and overthrew the government. And then the other fact that people then know about it is that a couple of weeks later, the Russian army marched in and crushed them. And that caused a lot of people to flee. Soros was one of them. And that is the root of his hatred of Russia.
So just like Brzezinski, he actually has a real reason to have a personal dislike of Russia.
Yeah, because as a Hungarian Jew, he had to get the hell out of there. Now, what people don't understand is the real reasons for what happened in 1956. Now, I'll just take a minute to explain them, because the whole story is explained so much about other events subsequently. If you go back to the end of World War One, Hungary was one half of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which along with Germany were the Central Powers, who were the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And they lost. And the Austro-Hungarian Empire came
along with the Ottomans. Don't forget the Ottomans.
Of course, yeah. Well, we'll get into them. I've got to be mentioning them later. But what happened was it fell apart, and you got the nations of Czechoslovakia and Austria, and etc. And Hungary became independent. But what happened then was a group of Jewish Bolsheviks, this is exactly the same thing that happened in Russia, who in Hungary were referred to as Lenin's boys. And they look very sinister when you see photographs of them, because they're all clad in black leather jackets and black leather caps. They seized power and immediately enacted the same reign of terror that we had seen in Russia. They were killing people left, right and centre, and killing Hungarians. Well, this didn't go down too well with some of the people that were left over from the Austro-Hungarian military. And also the same thing was happening in Germany at the time with the Freikorps, whereas the Freikorps were fighting Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht and the communists who had tried to seize power in Berlin. In Hungary, you had an almost year-long battle that devastated the country between Lenin's boys and the nationalist royalist forces of Admiral Miklós Horthy. And Horthy's forces won in the end with the help of the Romanians, because the Romanians invaded and took Budapest and kicked the Lenin's boys out. So from 1919 on, there were no Zionist Jews trying to control Hungary because the Hungarians had kicked them out. Well, obviously, when they kicked them out, they fled to Russia. And they were kept in Russia by Stalin. And in 1945, when he conquered Hungary again, he brought these Lenin's boys who had fled in 1919 back to Hungary and put them in charge. And they just picked up where they'd left off. So from 1945 to 1956, Communist Hungary was a hellhole. It was, Orwell's 1984 writ large. You had terrible brutalisation by the secret police. People just arrested for nothing. The scenario.
So George Soros was actually being persecuted by predominantly, or at least disproportionately, Jewish communists.
Yeah. Bolsheviks is a better term for it, because it's the Bolshevism is a perversion of communism. But anyway, by 1956, the Hungarians couldn't take it anymore, so they overthrew them. They didn't overthrow communism because they were quite happy to carry on exploring the communist experiment. They just didn't want it to be run by these murderous Jews. So they overthrew the murderous Jews and put their own Hungarian communists in charge. And they assured Moscow that while they had got rid of the Jews who were in control, there was no danger of them leaving the Warsaw Pact or abandoning communism. Well, unfortunately, Khrushchev didn't take them at the word, panicked, expected to see Hungary joining the West at any moment, and sent the troops in.
Well, of course, the CIA was busily, you know, conspiring and hoping to pry Hungary loose from the communists.
Yeah. I doubt they would have done it.
So you can see why Khrushchev would be paranoid.
Oh, very
just
much
because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
And as much as the majority of the Hungarians, you know, were being truthful, though, you know, there was obviously going to be those in Hungary who would love that to happen. So, yeah, you know, you can understand very much why Khrushchev did it. And Khrushchev didn't intend it to be as bloody as it became. But you had, what happened was, the Hungarian people rose up against the Soviet invasion. So you had, you know, people on the streets fighting tanks with petrol bombs. That wasn't what anybody wanted to happen.
So these are the formative memories for young George Soros, who then becomes a devotee of the so-called open society.
Well, yeah, it tells you why George Soros hates the Russians and why George Soros is the archenemy of the Zionists. And the other thing is, it's exactly the same thing that has happened in other countries. So it's important to, you know, 1956 Hungary is a good thing to study. David Irving wrote an excellent book whose title escapes me on it. There's little else in English.
Really?
But there's a huge amount of scholarship in Hungarian on it that's all been written since 1990. You know, the Hungarians, after the eventual fall of communism, underwent a period of national self-realization, where, you know, they explored what had happened, and they weren't looking to apportion blame. They were just looking to, you know, get to the truth for a change.
So this could be one reason why there are so-called anti-Semitic politicians doing quite well in Hungary.
Oh God, yes, yeah, exactly. That is exactly why they're doing well, because.
No, wait a minute, Ian. We know that anti-Semitism is always irrational and totally, you know, based on nothing. It's always a completely unconnected to reality. That's what we're told every day in the New York Times.
It's a weaponized term, isn't it?
It sure is.
So
getting back to Soros, okay, I actually agree with you to a large extent in your orientation towards Soros. I think he is a genuine idealist. He has a political philosophy of the open society based on Karl Popper. It was formed by these kinds of events. And of course, he's prejudiced against Russia because of this event too. But he's basically a very smart guy who really does believe his open society ideology. And that doesn't make him, you know, the second coming of Satan by any means. No. However, he also, he's made his money by all kinds of parasitical speculating, which isn't exactly, a lot of people would make that kind of money that way if they could. So that doesn't make him the worst human being in the world. However, he is known for currency manipulations that have targeted countries. When he went to war against Mahathir Mohamad in Malaysia, I'm still convinced that Mahathir Mohamad was the good guy.
I don't know about that. I'll have to take your word for it. But what I will say to everybody is that when assessing something about George Soros, you have to refract it through the prism of this piece of knowledge. And that is that George Soros has had a almost lifelong battle against the Zionists. And everything that he does is intended to be counter to what the Zionists are up to.
And so the Zionists are whipping up anti-Semitic, quote-unquote, hatred of Soros. This is the really hilarious thing, that the Zionists depend on people hating Jews to give them a reason to have this base in occupied Palestine. And then, so they create all kinds of ostensible hatred of Jews, a lot of it completely phony, and some of it they probably are paying off stooges to pretend to be Nazis and things like that. But isn't that ironic that they're the ones who are actually behind the hatred of Soros, which is tinged with this, oh, he's this evil, rich, conspiring Jew right out of the elders of Zion. Well, that's all coming out of Bibi Netanyahu's propaganda program.
Correct.
That's kind of hilarious.
2 points there. Not only were the Zionists paying people to pretend to be Nazis, go back to the Nazis. The Zionists were paying the Nazis to be the Nazis.
Or pretend to be Nazis, yeah. That's right.
Kristallnacht, the famous smashing of all the glass of all the Jewish synagogues and shops and things. When word reached Berlin, Joseph Goebbels flew into a rage and immediately ordered the SA and the SS, so no, it was just the SS by then, to stop it. So, you know, every SS barracks immediately scrambled, and there were armed SS troops on the streets, you know, protecting...
Protecting the Jews. Now, that's not the history that we see in Steven Spielberg movies.
No, you're reading David Irving's books, though, and other people who are brave enough to actually write the truth because they've bothered to redo the simple research. You know, I mean, the transcripts of the telephone conversations of the original Gauleiters to Goebbels in Berlin reporting this, are in the German archives. It's not difficult.
But wait a minute, David Irving's the only one who looks at the German archives, so I guess if you look at the archives, you must be an anti-Semitic Holocaust denier.
Well, the one thing about 90% of historians writing about World War II and the Nazi period is this curious fact. They don't speak German. They don't read German. So how can you write a valid history when you can only examine one side of the story? And also, not only do you need to be able to read and speak German, you need, now the Russian archives are open, you need to be able to read and speak Russian. And also, you have to be of good enough standing with the Russians that they will let you anywhere near their archives.
Well, of course, that's tricky, though, because the Russians have their own investment in anti-German propaganda.
Yes, they very much do. And their relationship with the Jews is a very complex and tricky one, too. And I've forgotten completely what the second point I was going to make
was. Well, we're talking about Soros, and I was arguing for a nuanced view of him as, an honest exponent of open society ideology who actually thinks that a lot of his money is going for worthy causes and may not be entirely wrong in all cases. However, he's been on the side of various kinds of currency manipulations.
But I remember what the other point was. The way that they attack Soros is quite cunning. They simply blame all their crimes on him.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait a minute. Give us an example of that.
I'm trying to think of one. There was what I wrote about one the other day.
Let's see, because we all know that he's blamed as he's an elder of Zion who's conspiring to take over the world, and of course that
even if they're near elders of Zion, he'd shoot them.
Yeah. Bibi Netanyahu and the neocons are a lot closer to the elders of Zion than Soros will ever be. That's true.
Oh God, yes. I apologize, folks. I'm not at 100% today, so my memory is not
the best. I'll take you at 75% over most people at 100%, Ian.
Oh, thank you. Soros, I'm not going to claim he's an angel. All I'm going to tell you is what I've found from looking into accusations against him. That if I were to research and find something that he'd done, that wasn't nice, and I could condemn, and I would report exactly what I find.
Okay, well, how about flooding Europe with refugees? This is really the number one accusation these days. The claim is that Jews thrive in societies that are not sort of monolithically, culturally, ethnically, racially pure. And we get this out of people like Kevin MacDonald, who's one of my fellow University of Wisconsin-Madison heretics, although somehow he managed to keep his job despite this kind of almost, neo-Nazi stuff, whereas I got chased out of the academy for even breathing a word of truth about 9/11. But in any case, Kevin MacDonald says that the Jewish community historically has tried to foster open immigration to dilute the homogeneity of these traditional societies, because the Jews will be better able to dominate those societies if they're heterogeneous, and therefore people like Soros love to bring in lots and lots of immigrants to wreck the ethnic cohesion and the cultural cohesion of those societies. So is there any truth in that? And if so, is Soros motivated by that?
Well, you've got that absolutely right. Just leave Soros out of it.
Okay.
I've studied in quite great detail. Being a European and being on the receiving end, I've studied this immigrant issue. And there are two flows of immigrants. One is across the Mediterranean from Libya. And the other is on rubber dinghies from Turkey to Greece. And once they got to Greece, some stayed in Greece. There's probably, might be as many as 500,000 in Greece. But Greece is the origin of the, well, this is going to sound familiar considering what's going on in Mexico at the moment, the huge migrant caravan.
Watch out for those caravans. I always thought of caravan as kind of a romantic image. Maybe it's my Orientalist background. But now a caravan is a bunch of scary, dark-skinned invaders who are going to destroy your country.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, a caravan was something that Cher sang about. But
Right.
But anyway, what happened was Mr. Erdogan, who is the slipperiest character around at the moment, did this. And he was blackmailing Europe. Basically, what he had was a couple of million Syrians that had fled the war and into Turkey, and they were living in refugee camps in southern Turkey. And so he recruited them and gave them effort. And I wrote about this at the time, and I put the dollar amount or the euro amount in the article and the other specifics, but I don't remember them well enough, but you can go to VT and find the article if you want. Now, they gave each one of them a certain amount. It was something like 1,500 euros. And passports. And bussed them up to the Mediterranean coast of Turkey. Put them on rubber boats and said, head for Greece. Your job is to go to Europe and live in Europe and just, you know, do whatever you want once you get there.
And of course, one shouldn't blame Erdogan too much for doing this. I mean, there's no reason why Turkey should have to deal with a flood of refugees created by Western policies. Turkey has less money to deal with them than Europe does. If I were Erdogan, I would feel totally justified in doing that.
Yeah, I can see that point of view. I can't say for sure, but my opinion is that he was blackmailing the leaders of Europe.
Well, sure. He's a politician. He's trying to get something in it for him, he hopes, obviously.
Now, the thing is, there were four, I think there were only four European leaders who didn't, you know, take the shekel. And I think that was the lead, Viktor Orban of Hungary. And the other three.
He's the evil anti-Semite, by the way, right?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'll get to why Hungary hates the Ottomans in a moment. I said I would get to that. Basically, you had four countries, Hungary, Slovenia, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, that closed the borders, that said, we're not letting these lot in, because regardless of what the media said, I mean, look at the I did the sensible thing. I looked at the Hungarian media during the time, because they were printing the truth about what was going on. And basically, this caravan that marched up through the Balkans and was stopped at the Hungarian border.
And this really is a big caravan. It's not kind of a figment of Trump's deranged imagination of these people from Honduras who might or might not even show up at the U.S. border in 2 months from now.
Yeah, this was a real one. Yeah. And it was read by, there were Turkish intelligence officers leading it and organizing it and funding it and financing it and blah, blah, blah. Because you know, the goal was to get these people to Germany. Because there is
a promised land.
Yeah. The Turks have had a plan to take over Germany for at least 40 years. Well, who's behind that is, that's too big a subject to get into now.
And frankly, I think it's going to be a while before that happens. I did a speaking tour of Turkish communities in Germany several years ago. Yeah. And so I got to see both the Turkish communities there and the Germans. And frankly, I don't think the Turks are going to be running the place for a long time.
Oh, God, no. Yeah, and I don't think they ever will, but somebody in Turkey has got that goal and is pushing for that.
Well, good luck with that, whoever that is.
It's a long-term one. But anyway, the goal was to get these people to Germany. They couldn't get there now because Slovenia and Hungary had closed the border, so you couldn't get north unless you went through Austria. So you know, then that's when the Austrians said, we're closing our border as well and building an excellent fence along the border. Yeah, the same thing the Hungarians did. The Hungarians got castigated for it. They didn't castigate the Austrians because, you know, they have to keep the Austrians on side to some degree because of European Union Harmony.
Okay, so quick question here. Okay, so this is basically done by Erdogan in Turkey, but isn't it true that Soros's foundations have set up, help the refugees stations and aid packages here and NGOs there that feed them and clothe them and things like that?
Yeah, because a lot of these people were genuine refugees who didn't need help. It was, that was a composite caravan that it was big. There were a lot of people in it, and a lot of them were just innocent Syrians plucked out the refugee camps and sent.
Well, I mean, almost all of them are basically just innocent refugees, aren't they?
Yeah, they were all victims, they were all refugees, but a large number of them have been selected because they were young men who were, had grown up. You see, the thing is, you could be like 20 now and Syrian and never seen anything but war since you were 10 years old. You could have spent the last 10 years of your life living in a refugee camp where there is no rule of law other than whoever's the nearest man with an AK-47 is.
So actually the rumors of refugee misbehavior probably have some basis in fact, just given that. I mean, every society's biggest problem is what to do with their young men, these testosterone-crazed young creatures who haven't fully been fully socialized yet. And, thinking about this kind of background that many of these people have, undoubtedly there have been, we know that there's some fake, stories about refugee misbehavior that have been weaponized and deployed, but there are probably some true ones as well.
Oh, there certainly are. And, I mean, I don't like saying that because, it's the same thing that is being said.
The political correctness police will call you a racist.
Sure, but I don't give a shit about that. What I care about is I don't often like to be in agreement with the paid Israeli stooges of the white nationalist movement, because that's their constant refrain. But the thing is, it's rubbish. But there is a grain of truth in it. And I am acknowledging the grain of truth. I am not agreeing with them.
Right, right. Well, of course, this is what the neocons would consider to be a noble lie. That is, you take something where there's some grain of truth somewhere, and this is a grain of truth that you want to turn into a huge propaganda cudgel to make hay out of, and then you invent all these BS exaggerations, which is what these people, have done. Because these migrants are not nothing but a bunch of crazed Muslim, Muslim rape army sort of thing. This is all garbage. Mm-hmm.
The thing is, if you've got a million Syrians, refugees, 10,000 of them might be a problem. And the thing is, it's not their fault that from the age of 10, all they've seen is rape and murder and violence and rampant endemic drug use. Because these refugee camps are run by non-governmental groups. Yes, all right, fine. Medicine Sans Frontières, the Red Cross, whatever, have got the name on them, but the power in the camps is the gunmen.
Yeah, there's some terrible stories about the way some of these groups are, they're filled with, like, sexual predators and stuff. Cynthia McKinney talked about Dynacor employees who were assigned to be guarding refugee camps who are all basically, pedophile pimps. There's a lot of that corruption, which means that life in these camps is probably not a whole lot of fun.
Well, I wouldn't even bother asking a Syrian woman why she's fled. To be a woman in one of these refugee camps is hellish. If you haven't got somebody with a gun protecting you, you're just going to get constantly raped.
So somebody should be taking responsibility for this problem and taking care of these people. Who is that? Well, who really created this problem? Doesn't this go back to the 9/11 perpetrators who set off this series of wars?
Yeah. And unfortunately, I was discussing this with Gordon yesterday. The outcome of the Syrian war is inevitably now going to be partition of Syria. That there is no avoiding that for the simple reason that nobody's going to be able to kick the Americans and the Turks out of the bit of Syria they've got hold of. And because the only way to kick them out is violence. And you can't attack America and Turkey in Syria without starting World War III.
Well, might the Turks chase the Americans out?
No.
Because the Americans are hanging around with the Turks' Kurdish enemies, which the Turks do not appreciate. One might think they could find a way to make this American occupation too costly. I mean, this is that, you know, so-called terrorism, as Robert Pape of the University of Chicago has written, it's a euphemism or a word that is usually used to describe occupied peoples who are finding ways to make the occupation of their lands too expensive for the occupier. So the occupier will give up patience and go home, just like America left Lebanon after the Marine bombing and left Somalia after the Mogadishu incident and so on and so forth. Somehow I would think the Turks are clever enough that they could arrange things in such a way that the continued U.S. presence in Syria will not be worth it for the American decision makers.
I think that what the Turks take on it is, we're just recreating the Ottoman Empire, and we will tolerate the presence of the Americans as long as it serves that eventual goal. Because, I mean, I wrote about this 4 years ago now, and there were the Prime Minister, or Erdogan's Prime Minister for the first part of Erdogan's rule, was Davutoglu. Davutoglu was one of the, well, he still is, no longer Prime Minister, but he was one of the leading Turkish academics on the subject of statehood, nationhood, that sort of thing, power politics. And in 2003, I think it was, he published a book. I can't remember the name of it, but this book is unknown in the West. It's written in Turkish. But in Turkey and surrounding countries like Armenia and the Kurdish regions, it's extremely well known because he wrote in it, and he actually used verbatim the word Lebensraum, which is German and means living room, and he's notorious in history because Hitler's use of it to describe what he was doing by pushing the Jews and other ethnic groups further east in Europe. He was creating Lebensraum for the expansion of the German Reich.
And he was stealing farmland in the Ukraine to feed the Germans as well.
Yes.
And in Mein Kampf, it sounds pretty obvious to me that he's planning genocide against those people. He's just going to get rid of them, the Slavs who were occupying all that good farmland.
Well, that's what the Germans did in 1917. Mm-hmm. There was no Ukraine. Ukraine... The word cry, the root word of Ukraine is cry, K-A-R-A-I, which in Old Russian means land or region or whatever. Ukraine means, in Old Russian, borderlands. It refers to the bits of the Russian Empire that bordered the Habsburg Empire, it was at the time. Now, this means that the only bit of modern-day Ukraine that is actually Ukraine are the two westernmost regions centred around the cities of Lvov and Volyn. And they are not ethnically Russian. They used to be part of the Habsburg Empire, and they are where Slavic East meets Germanic West, and they are an absolute mixing pot of different ethnicities. There are Ruthenians, Rusines, White Russians, Poles, Lithuanians, Germans, Czechs, Hungarians, by ethnicity, living in that region. And whenever there's been a war, they take it as an opportunity to murder and genocide each other. I mean, that's what Stepan Bandera did in the 30s and 40s. So he was a Ukrainian nationalist who was active in that region. And when, during this period when the Ukrainians had the whip hand because they were supporting the Germans, they massacred the Poles in the region. This was in response to, in the 1920s, when the Poles had the whip hand, they massacred the Germans. So only that little bit is Ukraine. The rest of it is 100% historically, linguistically, ethnically, culturally, and socially Russian. And that is the hard truth, that there is no Ukrainian nation prior to 1917, when the Germans created it in Kiev in exactly the same way the Americans have done many times around the world since. They just
shouldn't we fault Soros to some extent for funding Ukrainian nationalists, so-called?
Ukrainian nationalism is a difficult thing because I don't think you'll find it prior to about 1850.
Right, but you're avoiding my question. You admitted that Soros is anti-Russian.
I'm trying to think of how to couch the answer. I don't know what to make, because there is a third issue going on, and that's the city of Odessa and southern Ukraine. The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion was actually written in Odessa. Mm-hmm. The Odessa is the home city of Zionism. Mm-hmm.
And the Nazis actually did massacre large numbers of Jews in Odessa during World War II.
Yes. They knew who they were going for, though. They were going for the political elite and the people who, you know, were the Zionists, basically. Odessa is run by the Russian mafia. Mm-hmm. Which is entirely Jewish. Mm-hmm. And even under Stalin, when everybody did what Stalin said, Stalin didn't control Odessa. The Russian mafia, it was said during the time in the 1950s, the only way you could take control of Odessa would be with a couple of army divisions. So when you talk about Ukraine, you've always got to remember Odessa and the Zionists, and what do they want to do with it?
So Odessa is kind of the capital of Khazaria, in a sense.
Correct. It's the actual capital of Khazaria. That's where Khazaria was, southern Ukraine. Yeah. And further east.
Right. So when Preston James, our VT colleague, talks about the Khazarian mafia, that's kind of the headquarters, in a sense, is right there.
It's not kind of, it is the headquarters.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. It's where the protocols were written. You know, it's where that is where the capital of the Zionist Empire, of the Zionist Khazarian Empire was. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the name, its name then, because it was, 1,200 years ago?
Right. There are rumors of, as you say, the Russian mafia being basically headquartered there. And the stories that are told about the kind of, you know, prostitution and the rackets and the various forms of organized crime in Odessa, that's a big part of its history.
Well, look who they put in charge once Maidan happened. Saakashvili, Mikhail Saakashvili, who wasn't even Ukrainian, he's a Georgian. Basically, he was the man who was so brutal and ruthless dictator in Georgia that the Russians actually invaded Georgia to topple him. He was heavily supported by the CIA. He was heavily armed and financed by the US, but he was 100% Russian mafia. Hmm. And it's a misnomer to call them the Russian mafia, really, because they are entirely Jewish Zionists.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Friedman admits that in his book Red Mafia, which is such an important book. I guess it was worth killing him for. He's Jewish himself, so he wasn't in a huge hurry to underline this fact, but he certainly does admit it, that this is, they're not religious. A few of them are not even really aware of being Jewish, but basically it is an ethnically Jewish mafia.
Correct. And Saakashvili was put in charge of Odessa after Maidan, and he ran it for about 18 months to 2 years. He's since fallen from grace and been kicked out. But what he was doing when he was in charge of Odessa was overseeing the supply of ISIS, because all of the nasty stuff, the weapons, the bombs, the ammunition, all that good stuff that you need to run an army, was coming through Odessa. It was smuggled from Odessa across the Black Sea to the port of Georgia. Porti, I think. No, Porti's in Romania. Okay. There's a port in Georgia that's, I think it's 11 kilometres north of the Turkish border on the south side of the Black Sea. They were smuggling all the stuff for ISIS from Odessa to that port, where it was put on trucks and trucked south over the border, through the mountains, down through Turkey to Iraq and Syria. That was how most of the supplies and weapons to sustain ISIS got there for the first 5 or 6 years of the conflict.
Yeah, Turkey has a habit of kind of nodding and winking at all sorts of border trade that it's not supposed to be doing officially, on the downside supplying ISIS, on the positive side supplying Iran.
Mm. Well, at the same time, these convoys were going north-south in eastern Turkey with the weapons for ISIS, you had other convoys of tanker trucks going north to northwest. They were south to northwest from Iraq and Syria, carrying oil up to the Mediterranean coast.
Right.
Because there is a pipeline from the Mediterranean coast of Turkey into Europe. And what they were doing, they were trucking it up, hundreds and hundreds of trucks.
Supposedly Israel was involved in this too.
Oh, Israel's always involved. Yeah. The thing with Erdogan is, he changes sides about as many times as I change my underwear.
Yeah, a natural-born politician.
Oh, yeah. At different times he's been aligned with America. Different times he's been aligned with Russia. And his relationship with Netanyahu is a strange one. It's been at times extremely adversarial. And at other times it's been very, very close. And I think the best way of looking at it is like mafia dons. When it suits them, they cooperate with other mafia dons. And when it suits them, they are at odds with the mafia dons. And I include Putin in that.
Right. And this, of course, leads to the observation that if Erdogan's project is really to recreate the caliphate, he's really not much of a caliph. He's a very good Machiavellian politician who might build the power base for a new caliphate or for whatever he wants to build. Yeah. But he's so opportunistic that the thought of him as a sort of representative figurehead for a religion is enough to make us roll around on the floor laughing.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. When it comes to religion, I would include him alongside the Young Turks, who were nominally Muslims.
Right. And well, they were Danme, weren't they, for the most part? Crypto Jews.
Yes, they were crypto Jews. They were all Freemasons. They were all members of the Grand Orient Lodge in Salonika in northwest Greece.
Yes,
and that's how they were used to bring down the Ottoman Empire.
So getting back to Soros, because we only have maybe a little over 5 minutes left, I don't know if we fully managed to develop this more nuanced view of Soros that you have, as opposed to the demonized caricature coming out of the Zionist propaganda factories. But just because the Zionists hate him, doesn't mean he's perfect. But we do have this weird kind of cartoon image that we're getting now of Trump as being the heroic nationalist, warrior for the beleaguered white male race and sex and so on and so forth, with Soros as the sort of devil figure. They paint these Jewish horns on him. And with a few minutes left, let's take on that caricature, that propaganda line. I mean, it's quite just it's so ludicrous. You almost have to laugh at it.
Well, the great skill that they have displayed in demonizing Soros is they've made it all so damn believable. And the reason why it's so believable is that all of these crimes that you accuse him of are actual crimes. They actually happen. These are things that, they're not accusing him of things that aren't happening. What they're doing is, whenever they do something nasty and nefarious and Machiavellian, just blame good old George. And I should be able to give you a laundry list of examples. But
how about Jeffrey Epstein, the pedophile pimp who's presumably working with Israel to compromise American politicians, probably including Trump and Bill Clinton? Again, yes. I did want to mention that I think that Bill Clinton, despite the fact that he was opposed by a vast right-wing conspiracy that was very, very real. As far as I can tell, Bill Clinton really was, to some extent, knowingly involved in CIA cocaine trafficking through Arkansas when he was governor, in raping and pillaging women everywhere he went, it seemed like. and various other nefarious deeds. So that's, I mean, do you really think that Clinton was if not a saint, at least somebody who didn't do those things?
I think that there's been a lot of exaggeration. I mean, look at JFK.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, how many people does he have to rape before, you know, before it's a problem?
Well, did he rape them or not?
Well, I don't know. It's a heck of a right-wing conspiracy to manufacture awfully plausible-sounding people. I mean, even his biggest defenders in the mainstream media admitted during the election that they wished they'd actually taken those people seriously in the past.
I can only give—I haven't studied that in any detail to be able to say too much about that specific case. But I will give you an example that probably illustrates an answer quite well. That since JFK died, the exaggeration of his sexual activities has been immense. That if he had slept with all of the women that he's supposed to have and had as many mistresses as he's supposed to have, he wouldn't have had time to do anything else. And I mean, if you listen, and if you actually look at the testimonies of women that he actually did have liaisons with, like Angie Dickinson, he wasn't physically equipped to be a Lothario. That there has been a deliberate demonization. No, that's not the correct term. There's been a deliberate muddying of JFK's legacy and reputation since he died.
And do you think that's true for Martin Luther King as well? Because I've argued with people about this. I know people who actually take seriously what the FBI said about King.
It's a different age. We accept what of a mistress in most societies back then. I mean, in France, still to this day, if a politician doesn't have a mistress, then we see...
That's the scandal. National scandal would be... le président n'a pas de maîtresse would be the screaming headlines. Yeah. And, you know, they'd try to impeach him.
So I don't know about Martin Luther King. I don't know exactly what JFK...
But they are exaggerating these people on the sort of the left-wing and idealistic side of the spectrum get caricatured as these out-of-control Lotharios, if not rapists. Mm-hmm. And on the other side of the spectrum, we have male boy prostitutes staying overnight with George W. Bush in the White House, and it gets reported on page 12 of the mainstream newspaper, and nobody cares.
Well, the Franklin Boyce Home scandal, Judge Anthony Scalia's murder, and it was a murder. You know, these are Jerry Sandusky. These are just tips of a huge iceberg. And to go back to Jeffrey Epstein, it's not just Jeffrey Epstein. Tevfik Arif, who was one of Trump's... There's a company, I don't think it still exists, called the Bayrock International Group. Trump was one of the three major investors in it, along with Felix Sater of the Russian Mafia and Tevfik Arif of the Kazakh Mafia, and arguably also of the Turkish Mafia. And Tevfik Arif was basically the Kazakh stroke Turk version of Jeffrey Epstein. He was arrested by Turkish police on his luxury yacht off the Turkish coast with a load of underage girls a few years ago. He's just Jeffrey Epstein. Again, and the role of Jeffrey Epstein's handler was Ghislaine Maxwell. She was his personal assistant, but she was the daughter of the notorious Jewish British press baron, Robert Maxwell, who was a Zionist piece of scum. He really was scum. But his daughter was Epstein's PA and obviously Mossad handler. And what Epstein was doing when running that paedophile ring was developing what the Russians call compromat on anybody and anybody in a position of power. I mean, like you're saying, Bill Clinton took flights on his plane. So did Prince Andrew of Britain. Yeah, that Donald Trump was involved because Donald Trump was letting them use his properties to host these events, including Mar-a-Lago. I think Mar-a-Lago actually was the epicenter of it. So you know, this is just Trump allowing his mafia cronies.
So why won't that Trump-hating mainstream media go there with these really explosive issues?
Because they're owned, by and large, by the same people who are...
So it's all of this ostensible Trump hate coming out of the liberal media is severely limited and deceptive.
It's not very well done. I mean, I could give you some real ammunition to throw at Trump, and you know, that's far better than anything that has been held at him by the liberal media.
Well, give us, we only have about a minute left, so yeah. Give us a very short burst of stuff to throw at Trump.
1990, Donald Trump was bust. It's in his autobiography. He was walking down the street in New York with his then wife, which I think was Marla Maples. He saw a bum on the sidewalk, pointed to the bum, said to his wife, "That bum's got more money than I have right now." A year later, he was back like the phoenix from the flames with more money than ever. What happened? The Soviet Union fell and the Russian mafia came to America looking for people who they could work with and launder the billions that they were stealing from the Russian economy, because those billions were only usable to them if you could get them out of Russia and laundered into the clean economy. And Donald Trump had spent the 70s and 80s doing exactly that kind of money laundering for the Italian mafia in New York. So when the Russian mafia come along to New York looking for somebody to work with, they found Donald Trump. And from 1991, Donald Trump has been the US, and the Trump Organization has been the US end of a vast money laundering pipeline that runs from primarily the Alpha Bank, ALFA, in Russia to the Trump Organization. This was uncovered by independent researchers years ago when they found the email between the Trump Organization and the Alpha Bank. And those emails have since been buried and blamed on, is it the Laughing Bears or the Happy Bears or whatever, this fake Russian hacker group, as being fabricated as part of a Russian attempt to influence the U.S. elections. So,
wow. So Russiagate is real, but it's a billion times worse than what we're hearing about in the mainstream.
And
this is pretty much what we've been saying at Veterans Today for years now. And mm-hmm. every now and then the mainstream picks up a little bit of it, like the Washington Post actually did 2 or 3 months ago. They actually mentioned all this problem of Trump fronting for the Russian mob, but then it went back to bed and we're back to the usual nonsense. Anyway, Ian Greenhall, it's great to talk with you with so much uncommon frankness, talking about real history as opposed to the lies, deceptions, and myths that we're being force-fed. But we're at the end of the hour, so we're going to have to call it a show and then maybe do it again sometime, inshallah.
Pleasure as always, Kevin.
All right, thanks, Ian. Take care.
It's just the earth is dying. People are dying everywhere. We're killing people everywhere. We're killing the planet. It's nothing to worry about, you know. It's one of those things that...